This is Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell, awakening the world to the power of God's Word. And now here is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
We're glad you're with us this morning. As we think about the beauty of the world around us and the evidence that we can see through the world that there is a creator, it didn't just happen by chance. And we have with us Dr. Ken Boa, who's president of Reflections Ministries. He has a great interest in this topic, and in fact, as you'll be hearing a little bit into the program, he'll be teaching around the corner up at the Cove on this topic. Dr. Boa is engaged in life ministry of a relational evangelism and discipleship. You will see on his website, if you just Google Dr. Ken Boa, a wealth of material. And he draws from a rich educational experience with a Bachelor of Science from Case Institute of Technology, a Master of Theology from Dallas Theological Seminary, a doctorate from New York University, and a Doctor of Philosophy degree from University of Oxford in England. Ken, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, we're so glad to have you with us. This is a topic that is of, I think, great interest to all of us, because the world is telling us that science has pretty much ruled God out. There are many scientists today who believe that because of what they found, maybe in their microscope or in a test tube, that we don't need this fictitious idea that God created to guide our lives anymore. That crutch can be let go of because now science has given confirmation that really this could have happened given enough time and chance, and this thing we call evolution, it could have all come together. And so we want to get into the topic of the case for a creator, really the confirmations around us. Now, Ken, if we could start, before we dive into the topic, tell us a little more about yourself. How did you come to have interest in this topic?
Well, my background, my undergraduate degree was at Case Institute of Technology. It's now part of Western Reserve, so it became Case Western Reserve in Cleveland, Ohio. Mm-hmm. But it was a pretty rigorous scientific regimen whereby everyone had to kick off right away and take the same courses for the first 2 years. It was sort of like an MIT kind of regimen there. And so we hit the ground running and differential equations and calculus and physics and chemistry and all of these kinds of things, which was wonderful to have such a rigorous background, because in doing so, it forced me to have an awareness of science from an insider's point of view. And I've always appreciated that concept, opportunity for me to have had that background. I was an astronomy major, mm-hmm. and I've always been interested then in the sciences from that standpoint. And having come to faith in Christ, which was about only a few weeks after my graduation from Case, actually, I immediately began to see that it was important for me to connect things together. And after going to seminary, when I started seminary, I saw a kind of a convergence and had a bit of an epiphany after about a year, where I had gone through a conscious worldview transition from being effectively a scientific humanist to now a Christian theist. And that was a hard journey for me to take, but it was great for me to process that. And as a brand new believer, because I was only a believer for 6 months when I started seminary, I came across people I'd never heard of, like C.S. Lewis and at that time Francis Schaeffer's earliest books, which forced me to see things from an entirely new perspective, and had a kind of an epiphany whereby I saw all things coming and being derived from the mind of the eternal, infinite God. And it was a profound experience, because I saw suddenly, you know, science and art and music and literature and history, philosophy, all these things can converge together in a coherent way. And so that was, for me, a kind of an epiphany that was very powerful. And having done that then, I've been interested ever since in trying to stay current and seeing how we can leverage insights from the natural world and understanding what that looks like in apprehending the inferences for this world that point beyond itself to the idea of a designer. So I've always been intrigued by that.
Yeah, now what fascinates me is I look at so many brilliant minds who end up in the realm of science, quite often the journey like yours, and this is, you may clarify your own journey after I say this, seems to be that people read, as you mentioned, C.S. Lewis, Francis Schaeffer, maybe the philosophical side of things, maybe apologetics, looking at issues like the problem of evil. But after someone, along with an analytical mind of sorts, comes to embrace the God of the creation, comes to believe in a Christian God, then it's as though their eyes are opened up to see how the creation provides so much evidence. In other words, I don't know that many scientists who, through the creation itself, discovered the Creator. It seems almost as though they've come in the back door and then come to appreciate what's around them. And so I want to ask this question. Do you find the creation to have just clues that there is a God, or real confirmations?
Yes, I think that, for me at least, I see growing evidences and confirmations that kind of conspire together to provide an understanding that what we have is a divine discourse, as Alvin Plantinga puts it in his wonderful recent book, Where the Conflict Really Lies, Science, Religion, and Naturalism. And there he discusses the whole idea of perceiving design and the nature of a discourse. And as I see it, we live in a time that is unprecedented insofar as evidences from new discoveries, new technologies, have become the entry point to a greater apprehension of elegance, beauty, order, complexity, information that we've never been able to apprehend before. In other words, it's taken actual new discoveries in science to help us see how rich and wonderful this world is. And so the interesting tool that's happening in our own time is that as skepticism has been increasing in our culture, which we certainly know it has been, God, I believe, also increases and bumps up the evidence. It's what Pascal used to argue in Pensée, where he would say that a choice is there, and that there's always going to be enough evidence to satisfy the heart of the believer, but always enough ambiguity to enable the non-believer who chooses not to take to follow the way to rationalize disbelief. And as skepticism increases, I think in our time, evidence has gone up, especially in the last 40 years. It's astonishing what's happened on a number of levels that we now have insights that we never could have dreamed before.
Beautifully stated. I just love what you're saying. I see it, and I believe you're right. It astonishes me that we can have these scientists who, because their minds are closed to the idea of a spiritual world, actually, as they see things that look like, to me, like clear evidences, the more detail they find, the more they seem convinced that we don't need there to be a God anymore. And I'm astonished by that.
Yeah, but it is astonishing, yeah. In fact, what I find is happening is, as you know, the new atheists are of a very less charitable lot than the older atheists used to be. The new atheists are less subtle. They are more shrill. They are using more ad hominem and guilt by association arguments rather than cogent logic. And it's more of an emotional thing. And I believe the reason for this in part is because they have a sense that things are shifting away from them. That is to say, as the evidence for that that really implies design and order and all of these things continues to mount, their neo-Darwinian apprehension of the world becomes less and less adequate to account for it, that increased evidence, because it's based upon an outdated and increasingly anemic scheme of mutations plus natural selection, which can account for a modest variation within genetic limits, but certainly not the major kinds of changes that are necessary. Michael Behe demonstrates this nicely in his book, The Limits, The Edge of Evolution, where there are clearly limits. And what's interesting along these lines, I'm thinking about a book I recently read by a famous atheist, Thomas Nagel. And this atheist wrote a book called Mind and Cosmos, Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. Well, you can be sure that didn't make him popular with his atheistic friends. He's actually arguing against the neo-Darwinian approach. And the reality is that he is now refuting and showing that mind, consciousness, that the conscience, that morality, that these are features that we see in intelligent agents cannot be accounted for by a materialist view of the world. However, what's interesting is because he's so committed to an atheistic perspective, and he says, I have no sensus divinitatis in me at all. So he's so convinced by that that having refuted the neo-Darwinian account, he then goes off in the flights of absurdity and fancy to try to argue for some emerging consciousness that comes from the particles themselves. And so it becomes virtually silly. But it's consistent with my prediction that over, and I've been making this prediction for a number of years, that I see a paradigm shift in the making. And this paradigm shift is going to move us away from a materialist vision of nature. And it's going to move us toward something that's radically different. But it will not be theism, because there's too much that involves in terms of changing and humbling oneself and all of the spiritual barriers. And that's why the Romans 1 argument comes to play. But rather, it will become, I think, pantheistic, something that will be they will become what C.S. Lewis predicted would be the materialist magician.
Mm.
The idea of floating between two stories, the upper and the lower, as it suits them, and not worrying about the irrationality that produces.
It's sort of as though modernism, which really gave us our science, is holding science together. Postmodernism is the sea in which it floats, and the seas get into the boat, would you say? Because postmodernism lets anything go, and when it comes into science, suddenly, well, it's kind of what we have.
Yeah, and it doesn't fit very well. Of course, no one wants to have to ride over a bridge that was built by a postmodernist architect and engineer. but then I don't know many engineers who are postmodern in that respect. So what you have an interesting, and as you know, there's a whole, that's a loose term, and it could mean a number of things. Is it just a logical implication of modernism, or is it a new thing? But bottom line is, it's a movement away from the idea of anything that's objective as a referent, whether it's true, good or beautiful. Those, the three transcendentals, are now being denied as being real basis for reality at all, and it becomes just a more subjective understanding of the true, the good, and the beautiful.
Hmm. Ken, let's talk for a minute about what you'll be doing at the Cove. To the listeners, Ken will be speaking, and if some of this kind of went around you, over your head, or just didn't interest you, his conversation is going to be very practical. September 20 to 22nd, talking about God of Wonders, the creator of his handiwork. Can you summarize, Ken, what's going to happen there at the Cove?
Yes, because it won't be as bad as what we've just been talking about.
No. It's going to be...
but your good questions have actually stimulated that. And sometimes it's just necessary, you know, for us to have a bit of a little sense of rigor there. But let me describe briefly what I would like to do, what I plan to do at the Cove here. That it's going to actually involve three presentations, and they're all highly visual presentations. One of them I call Pointers in the Microcosm and Macrocosm. And it's a quick-paced journey to the uttermost limits of the universe, both near and far. And we stop off and see extraordinary creatures and objects on every scale of magnitude and what they point to. And so it's my whole goal there is to basically contextualize and stretch people's imaginations about the greatness of who God is and the realization that God is a lot more wonderful than you ever dreamed him to be, and your capacity to worship is related to your grasp of his greatness. And so I'm going to leverage nature to point beyond itself to the creator of nature. Mm. And so it's a fun,
fantastic,
fun journey.
Oh, that really sounds like fun.
Yeah, we're going to look at over 40 orders of magnitude, and we're going to see from the incredibly tiny, beyond our comprehension, to the inexpressibly and terrifyingly large. So it's a fun, fun journey. And then the second and third presentations will be two parts of what I call Fearfully and Wonderfully Made. And it's exploring the many marvels of the human body And we're going to looking at the senses. We're going to look at the skeleton. We're going to look at different parts and just give a wonderful overview of how these things point to a designer and the beauty and the elegance that goes beyond our imaginations. Again, the more you learn about how we have been made, David's image of fearfully and wonderfully made rings true in Psalm 139:14. So that's a fun two-part presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fourth presentation, the last part, will be Science, Faith, and Reason. And that's a visual presentation that's going to, again, these are all very, very filled with images and so forth, very rich visual imagery. And it's going to develop the implications of four fundamental features of the world. First of all, the evidence for the universe's beginning. And secondly, the fine-tuning of the cosmos. And third, problems with the origin of even the simplest of cells. And fourth, the nature of information, especially related to DNA. And so we're going to be exploring those dynamics as well and showing that the features of this world are increasingly, as through science and through scientific understanding, especially in the last few decades, increasing our appreciation and grasp of the fact that this world is more mysterious, marvelous, rich, and complex than we could have ever dreamed. So, and then pulling out some of the implications as well of what does that look like for how we ought to live our lives. So it's the so what factor is important. Because one of the things I love to do, and no matter what the topic is, I find that I love to synthesize and then to translate without dumbing it down and then applying so that we walk away with the so what factor as well.
Hmm. Why don't we go ahead and dive into those four areas you mentioned. Take what is last and pull it right up front here for this interview. Okay. I know we can only touch on them, but I think it will pique our listeners' interest and have some practical help for us today, because those four areas give us truly what we're looking for, confirmations of a creator. So we start with the beginning of things. I suppose we can rightly say, can we not, Ken, that whereas science used to assume an eternal universe, which leaves us kind of questioning how's this whole Genesis thing fit in, to now this mainstream confirmation that everything began at a certain point in time, which fits with the biblical account incredibly so.
Yes.
Is that how you see it?
Yes, and that was really against the bias of most astronomers years ago, because they wanted a steady-state theory. And the steady-state theory was that somehow the universe was infinitely old and matter was infinitely old, and they wanted that so that it could avoid that very implication. And so when that was now seen to be not an option, and they were more or less forced against their bias to buy it, especially when there was evidence from the microwave background radiation that was Penzias and another scientist discovered at Bell Labs, that they've discovered that this actually pointed to a confirmation of a beginning point for the universe. The whole idea of also the expansion, Hubble and so forth, and moving it backwards in time. So all of that was postulated as the whole idea of a Big Bang, which was a pejorative term originally. They didn't, eventually that was more and more confirmed, and by 1965 that became a new development where, against their desire, they were forced into the idea of a beginning event. And so what you have here is pushing it back to fractions, 10 to the minus 34 seconds after the Big Bang, and you're pushing it back as far as you can get. But what people don't want to speculate is what was before then. But the reality is that matter, energy, space, and time were brought into being. Mm-hmm. Some people try to get around that by talking about some kind of a quantum foam they like to talk about. But mm-hmm. You see, as Francis Schaeffer used to say, nothing produces nothing. And he used to use a phrase, nothing, nothing. And mm-hmm. They're cheating by trying to have quantum foam as if there was something before there was the creation. But the whole idea is that the very fabric of space and time, of matter and of energy, brought into being, which implies, if you're thinking about this, that something transcendent, something that transcends matter, energy, space, and time, there must have been some kind of an agency that brought that into being, brought that about. And this is the uncomfortable implication that many are trying to avoid. But I find that this is where we go. So there are different features of the world. And when we think about a time when from the first time we can say the universe had a beginning. I use this if proposition in my book, I'm Glad You Asked. If anything now exists, and something must be eternal, or else something not eternal must have emerged from nothing. And so the first proposition is, if anything now exists, most people agree with that, although some Buddhists say it's all an illusion, but you can't live that way. Something must be eternal, which they hoped was the universe, or else something not eternal must have emerged from nothing. And that is to say the universe has now been shown to be contingent, and that it requires a beginning event. It does not account for itself. So the idea of it being an illusion or being coming that is eternal or that it emerged from nothing, all of those have now actually moved us more and more toward the idea of something that's not eternal, something contingent arriving from something that is eternal. Something that is eternal, and so that eternal, of course, is we would say that's God Himself, the eternal agency. So,
and some listeners. Sometimes people hear Big Bang, they think there's another effort for science to find a way to get around all this without God. And yes, scientists try to explain everything without putting God in an equation, and that's fine. That's science.
Yeah.
But science cannot disprove God. And what amazes me is reading, say, Stephen Hawking and his effort to explain the Big Bang. I remember reading in one of his books, it's the idea that, well, you know, before all this, there was no time, and so it takes away the problem. And I look at that and I think, exactly, there was no time. There was eternity, which is what God's all about, you know? I mean, he has nothing other than this cloud, this aura of intelligence that makes people think, well, maybe he's God. You know, maybe there are scientists who really know there is no God, but there are not. Listeners, there's no way to disprove God, but all the evidence, common sense tells you, this massive universe came from something, and it didn't just happen.
Doesn't account for itself. It's contingent, not necessary. God, by contrast, is a necessary being. It is his essence to be. His being and his essence are one, so he must always be. So there's never a time when God was not. So when people raise this silly objection, where did God come from? Mm. They're immediately trying to reduce God to categories of space and time.
Right, right.
Which is a category error. It's a common blunder. Even Dawkins makes that kind of blunder.
Yes, but it does.
It's a fundamental error that is easily shown to be a category blunder because you're trying to reduce them to his creation, space and time. It doesn't work.
Yeah, so the beginnings of all things, even based on what we find through science, points us toward God. It's truly an evidence. I see it that way, too. What about the fine-tuning issue?
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
What's interesting
about
on the fine-tuning issue is that you're dealing with a growing array of components or factors that all have to be just right, a variety of factors or parameters for the universe were set in place essentially at the initial moment or within a small fraction of the first second. And so what you have to have is everything, all the fundamental forces, the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, the electromagnetic force, the gravitational, all of these have to be in perfect proportion and a very tiny, tiny movement or change in one of these forces, and none of them had to be this way. But the slightest tweak of these forces would render the possibility of life impossible because you wouldn't have actually had galaxies and then stars and planets and so forth that could be formed. That the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. That's a quote from Stephen Hawking from one of his earlier books. Mm-hmm. For example, the expansion rate of the universe as well. If it's one part in 10 to the minus 55, I believe it is, right around that range, if it was changed in one part to that degree, again, what would have happened is the universe would not have been either able to attract material into the gases, galaxies, and likes. It has to be precisely balanced. Or it would have caved back if it was the other way, slightly bit more slowly. It would have actually had a crunch on itself. The big crunch would have taken place long ago. Either way, you wouldn't have life. The ratio of protons to neutrons is so precise that one change in one part in 10 to the 37 and it couldn't work. And these are impossibly big numbers. So there's a growing array. It has to be just the right sun. It has to be just the right planet. It has to have a right plant. A moon and the proportionality of there. All these kinds of things, the more we look, the more these features multiply to where there are now several hundreds of them. And the upshot of this is it looks like we are in a universe where there are just right galaxy, star masses, molecules, particles, atoms. All these have to be just so in such a way that it's like a Goldilocks universe. And it looks like it was prepared and designed just so that we could have this discussion. And people don't like that implication. And so what's happened in recent years has been this whole multiverse claim, that more and more people are claiming that now we just might be one of an infinite number of universes. And I find that to be a more or less desperate measure to avoid the obvious implications of the fine-tuning of the cosmos. And and it's important to understand in the multiverse theory that they may be elegant mathematically, but that's all they are, is mathematics and systems that are very, very volatile. And the fact is that there's not a bit of empirical evidence to support the idea of another cosmos, precisely because you couldn't be aware of another cosmos. So
okay,
it's all mathematical structures.
We're going to have to take a quick station break here, and we're going to finish the multiverse concept, a few other things, and then get into the question, what about aliens?
You are listening to Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. To discover more about Beyond Words and the other ministries of Scripture Awakening, visit us on the web at scriptureawakening.com. While there, you can learn about our amazingly successful Bible reading program, B90, or Bible in 90 Days. You can review the extensive catalog of our versatile Bible study series titled Be Next. You can also download free podcasts from all Beyond Words programs. Check out B90, Be Next, and Beyond at scriptureawakening.com. Here once again is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
Welcome back. We're glad you're with us. And we're into the topic of confirmations of a creator. We have Dr. Ken Boa with us, who is a doctor of philosophy and of science. He has written a wealth of material, many excellent books. His website is one of the best repositories of teaching materials on a wide, vast variety of topics. You need to go there. Ken, I believe it's kenboa.org, is that right?
That is correct, yeah.
It is a wealth of material for your Sunday school class, for your own development, your teaching. So Ken, we thank you for taking time to be with us today. And we were talking some about the idea of a multiverse. And I agree, it's a little bit of a, when I'm stuck, I'm going to create a scenario that's imaginary. You can't, you know, scientists tell us the universe is expanding at this outstanding rate such that we can't measure light beyond a certain distance. So there's no way we could see beyond to see if there are other universes. And now we're going to take this fictitious model and then laugh at Christians who have faith in God. But isn't that kind of the same thing, trying to find faith in something?
Yeah, it's actually more extreme because what's happening now is that many scientists are willing to buy into this theoretical model that, as I said before, has no empirical warrant, no basis for in scientific evidence directly. And they're speculating upon worlds where there are other laws of physics, so that they're willing actually in a way to deny the most fundamental laws of physics, first and second laws of thermodynamics, in order to get around the implication that this universe was finely tuned for life as we know it. And so who's living by faith now is because here they're taking the most fundamental laws of physics itself, thermodynamics, and saying that we're going to be willing to hold that at arm's length, even though we don't have any empirical evidence, but our mathematical construct might work. This way, they can account for the idea that we might just happen to be in the right universe. In other words, we won the lottery. And when you take that kind of a logic, it'd be like a person going to a card game, and he's dealt a he deals out poker hands, and he deals out one guy gets a royal flush, and it'd be surprising. But then the guy gets a second royal, and then a third and a fourth. After a while, you'd get really suspicious about those cards or the dealing of this. And a person, it'd be, but another person could say, "Oh, it just happens to be that we happen to be in one of those universes where a person could have six royal flushes in a row." Where would you put your money? Where would you bet? Or if a person claimed he had a fair coin and he tossed it and got heads 100 times in a row, you get real suspicious after that, saying, "Is it possible that we're just in one of the infinite number of universes where such an event could take place, or is it more plausible that that it has two heads and that it's rigged?" My point is that we know better. We don't bet that way, and I'm saying simply that that the evidence is such that we have a universe that's so finely tuned that if you take only even a few dozen of these finely tuned parameters, the probability of having the just right conditions whereby there could be life is something less than one chance in 10 to the 200th. And then they say, well, what if there's a huge number of planets? Okay, let's be generous and say there are 10 to the 20 such planets. Okay, now instead of 10 to the minus 200, it could be 10 to the minus 180. In other words, it doesn't work. And so this is raising questions in some people's minds as to whether we are, in fact, it took a universe this big, this old, this of this nature to create the conditions where we could have this one conversation. Remember the movie Cause Contact with Jodie Foster, and the basic theme was what a waste it would be to have such a universe and we're the only ones there. But actually, though, what if it turned out it required a universe this way, this large, for us to have the context in which you'd have the right kind of planet, the right kind of sun, and the right kind of galaxy to have their life-sustaining features? In other words, it would not be a waste if it was designed in that way. So no one can know for sure. God could have created, especially created something else, and indeed he did with angels and so forth. But I find the evidence is really moving more and more in our direction.
Yeah, and it's not a waste if God chooses to do it. It perhaps shows his grandeur that this vast universe to which we know we cannot fathom an ending point, if he made all that, it shows how great he is. And maybe it's a small thing to him.
Yeah, and that this biosphere is the thinnest island between the incomprehensibly large and the incomprehensibly small. This is the exception in the universe. This biosphere on our planet.
Yes.
And then we have, even if you had a life permitting planet with all those parameters, then you have to have biogenesis, which brings me to the third feature of this world, that the evidence for the nature of the simplest cell, turns out there isn't a simple cell. Even the prokaryotes and the eukaryotes, the simplest bacteria, these basic cells are not basic at all. Even those most so-called simple cells would be as complex as the city of Asheville or of Atlanta if you enlarge them to that size. They're exquisitely complex, and Darwin had no idea. That's why Michael Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box, discusses this very idea, that we would have never dreamed. Because the idea, well, maybe we're just made out of little Legos. They're all kind of blobs of protoplasm. Turns out that those cells are as rich and complex as a whole body in many ways.
Yes, absolutely. I want to backtrack just a minute before we get more into the idea of where did life come from itself. You were throwing out these numbers. At first you were talking about 10 to the 37 as you're talking about the fundamental elements of the universe, or the forces, fundamental forces, and then you got into the 10 to the 200 something. I believe that we're talking about numbers greater than the total number of protons in the universe, as far as we know. I mean, these numbers are so great that we can't fathom them. And I hope the listeners have a sense. And I wanted to say this, some of what you're talking about with the Goldilocks principle in the universe. Paul Davies, when I read his stuff, he seems to be another man who's kind of stuck because he sees so much evidence in the cosmos out there that this couldn't have just happened. it's phenomenal, but he's not willing to admit there's a God, so he comes up with these incredible theories. So I just wanted to add that the 2 cents. My amen to your great words about the great world out there. Now you're moving us toward the micro, toward the beginning of all things in terms of life. And there used to be a theory, wasn't there, in science that it could just, much like a rag given heat and the right maybe gasoline, it might just combust. You might have something in your garbage can come to life. A fire might start because of the heat and chemicals. Well, maybe life started that way, and that was an old theory that scientists have long since given up on, and yet they're kind of coming back to it, aren't they?
It's remarkable, because it was spontaneous generation was a view that some held, and the idea that just spontaneously generated. But now it's amazing, because the evidence for the nature of life is such that even a protein can't spontaneously generate. A viable protein is so exquisitely complex to produce, and let alone DNA, and let alone all the organelles that make up the cell itself, and then all of these have to merge together, and even that's not alive. DNA is not alive. Mm-hmm. But then when we suddenly get the convergence of all those things within the cell, suddenly there reaches this mysterious thing where these inanimate components all suddenly merge together in such a way that the thing as a whole takes on a new feature, the mystery of life itself, which cannot be reduced to the components themselves, but transcends those components. And so this whole idea of life, biogenesis, which just means the origin of life, the generation of life, this has become an increasingly complex arena whereby the probability of, even forget about a cell producing, as I say, forming DNA or protein, it becomes extremely, it's the probabilities, again, are surpassingly tiny. You mentioned about the number of atoms in the universe is only about 10 to the 80. So when we're talking about these numbers, it's just beyond, it boggles the imagination, the figures that are involved in creating and synthesizing protein, DNA, all of these kind of features. So it's a fun discussion, and we look at that as well in these presentations that I'm going to be doing at the COBE, but it's really intriguing to me. Again, I'm excited about all these things because we didn't know about these things until X-ray crystallography and nuclear resonance, nuclear diffraction and so forth. We didn't grasp nuclear magnetic resonance and all those kinds of things. We didn't know about these things. And now we have an ability to peer into these finely tuned structures and to see the bacterial flagellum for what it is, and in each of these things, these micro motors that are within our bodies, and we have scores and scores of these little machines that are more elegant in their nature than anything we can actually make. And when the more we try to reverse engineer nature, we more amazed we discover that our reverse engineering is primitive in comparison. So it's all fun stuff. The evidence is moving and mounting, and again, in favor of complexity and richness and all of these things, including information, which is my fourth component.
Before you go on, we had a while back had Faz Rana on just talking about the creation of a synthetic cell. And science would say, you know, we can make life. Look, we're going to one day, and it's coming up soon, we're going to make a synthetic cell. And he's saying, I agree, that day will come soon. But you know what? It's a building of technology through generations of science and effort with the best of human minds and equipment to finally create this little artificial thing, this single cell. And it's only further evidence, he says, that it takes a designer to create something so complex.
Yeah.
You know, we're made in God's image. It's because God made us that we can even do this. And so
even do that, yeah. And, of course, that old story about the scientist who said, give me some dirt and we can manufacture that. And God said, well, you make your own dirt.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, because something had to bring it into being in the first place. But the very point is that it requires terrific amount of technology, of intelligence, of order and organization to synthesize not a cell, but a protein, mm-hmm. let alone these
yes.
things. And I'm impressed with technology. I truly am. I mean, the idea yeah. of a 3D printers and all that we're able to do, and I was reading about this $300,000 so-called hamburger that they're trying to make out of this material. But the fact is, it's astonishing what we can see, but it makes us, it's a dangerous arrogance if we begin to think now that we're becoming like God, because we're only scratching the surface, and the more we learn on everything, on every order of magnitude of the cell, of the membrane itself, turns out to be, it raises new questions we couldn't have even imagined before.
Yes, I mean, we should be becoming more humble as a race, as a people, the more we discover. It amazes me that some people are becoming more brazen and mm-hmm. arrogant, and mm-hmm. just coming to science with the understanding before they even begin science, there cannot be a God, and then they set out to try to disprove it, and none of them have been successful. So we come now to, you're talking about the complexity of proteins, and we come to this idea of information being replicated. Open that topic
yes.
up for us, if you will.
Yeah, because it's really remarkable when we see, after looking at the cell itself and looking at these, and we could discuss this a great deal more, which I plan to do when I'm doing my presentation, but the nature of information, that our bodies are rich in information, but there can be no sudden infusion of complex information through an undirected natural process. We look at things in nature, and it has wonderful patterns and complex things that are there, but even snowflakes, as beautiful as they are, don't have information per se. A pattern's not the same as design. And that that the question of where does information come from is remarkable, because we're dealing here with information. It's neither matter nor energy. Many people don't know this. If you take, for example, a DVD, and then you record a movie on it, that DVD does not weigh anything more than it did before. The information transcends the material itself. Or we're having this conversation. It's being recorded. It goes on radio. People pick it up through, and it goes through an electronic, it's converted into a digital format. Then people hear it in an auditory manner. Someone could transcribe it, and now it's a physical thing, and it's a printout. So, but the information is the same, regardless of whether it's energy or matter. It transcends those things. So it's fascinating to me that you're dealing with something that's an entirely new realm itself. So it's really extraordinary here. It has to do with intentionality, because you can't have information without intention. Mm. And so the question is, show me a message that doesn't come from a mind.
Now, what are you going to do with Richard Dawkins, say, in A Blind Watchmaker? He writes and he says, hey, the universe has been, these things have built one on the other like a sifting
yeah.
process. You know, it's just given enough time. What do you do with that?
Yeah, he uses this this idea of a lot of his books, and one of them is Climbing Mount Improbable, as well
mm-hmm.
as that.
Yes.
And essentially, he has this little machine that he says. And suppose we have the theory of evolution is the outcome we're looking for here. And so we have 26 letters on a wheel, and all it has to, and that wheel then, once you hit T, that's it. You've got that. Now you can do, now the next wheel, all you need is an H. And then all you need is an E. And so that's, now we have the, and theory, and so forth down the road. And so, yeah, it's, you can break it down into small bites, he claims. And the probability, though, it doesn't seem to be very great in our favor. It actually turns out that you can break it down, so it's one chance in 10 to the one chance in 26, and then the next one's one in 26. What he fails to grasp, and it's a fundamental blunder that's astonishing to me that is missed, is this: he's backloading the information. He's actually looking for a particular outcome as a result, which means he's fed the information in through the back door. In other words, if your end product is the theory of evolution, then it would be no problem then to, you know, eventually, and if you know to stop the wheel at the T-H-E, T-H-E-R-Y, and so forth, sure, there's no problem. But he's cheating by providing the information that you're looking for at the front end. It doesn't work that way. So I'm not sure if I'm making myself clear, but the bottom
totally.
Is that it's a fundamental error in logic, and it does not work that way. It turns out that it cannot be climbed by small little iterations, and there's so much on this. There's a tremendous literature on this.
Yeah.
Well, but so it's a basic blunder, and it illustrates the fact that many times scientists don't make the best logicians or philosophers, and this is an evidence. If you ever saw the movie Expelled, you might recall when you recall there where he's kind of forced almost against his will to admit the idea of something extraterrestrial as having caused that. Ben Stein gets him to that point.
We're talking about Richard Dawkins, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, with Richard Dawkins, I'm sorry. And he gets to that point where he says maybe it came from out from beyond. But that's panspermia. That is to say, the information is so rich it couldn't have evolved on Earth, but maybe it came from an extraterrestrial source. And when it was appalling to him because he was embarrassed by that, and he wanted to claim that he never said that, and yet it was right on the film. And
right.
So it's amazing. But that's the kind of blunder you have, because when you see, okay, it can't have had here, but maybe it had in another world. Well, you know the obvious area there is, where did that come from? So you're just pushing it back one step.
Yeah, but
I find it to be compelling in our time.
Yeah. Now, Ken, maybe in defense of a Richard Dawkins panspermia, there isn't enough. People read his stuff and say there's not enough time on planet Earth for possibly the information to have accumulated to the level as to create intelligent life. So it must have come from somewhere else. And maybe there is enough time somewhere else in the universe, or if there are multi-universes, somewhere there is enough time for life to evolve and its micro levels, a good foundation for complex life on planet Earth. But where, I agree with you, even in the micro level, it's much more complex than we give it. How does it start without a God?
How did it even start? Yeah, so I just say, we can just start with something simple. Don't worry about, forget about the cell. All you need to consider, for example, is the nature of the cell, the proteins themselves, and as I was saying, hundreds of amino acids requires a gradual buildup of peptide bonds in a precisely ordered sequence, and all of them have to be left-handed, and yet they appear naturally in both forms in an equal amount. So you got really a problem here, and there's so much to this that people have abandoned that idea of the synthesis of that, and they've come up with another what they call the RNA world, and I don't worry about that. But the point is they're desperate to find some way of avoiding doing an end run. So that when Stephen Meyer came up with his book, The Signature of the Cell, again, most people didn't read it properly but frankly, he creates what I believe is a virtually airtight argument for this elegance and complexity. Mm-hmm. And often, instead of actually dealing with it in its own terms, they'll just hear each other's arguments against it.
Yeah, to me, there's a level in which the secular scientist is becoming very close-minded. And I hope and pray if someone's listening with a scientific background, that you'll open your mind. Open your mind by reading books on both sides of an issue and read other people. You know, Ken started this program talking about C.S. Lewis and Francis Schaeffer, and they're very intellectual people who may not make science their main focus, but think about broader disciplines. You know, science isn't the only discipline out there of academic study that could give evidence of a creator. Think about philosophy, theology. Read your Bible. Look, you're living in a world. You're not living in a test tube. You know, look at the whole world around you. Ken, can you help me? You have written on all kinds of topics. You deal with atheism from all the different fronts. What are other evidences of a creator beyond just the scientific side of it? You know, touch on maybe one of your favorites.
There are so many. In addition to these, just looking at features of the world, consider human consciousness, which Nagel balked at, and where does that come from? It cannot come from a materialistic world. A rationality. How do we know that we are even thinking clearly? If we are the product of irrational forces, then rationality would be questionable. How would you trust your own reasoning when you say it's not that it's a product of just the impersonal plus time and chance? Moral values and obligations, and everyone, even though they claim that there's no, that there, some people may claim that there are no objectives, they can't live that way. All you have to do to turn a relativist into an absolutist is cut in front of them in line. He'd be outraged. Beauty, the nature of beauty, and the idea of a Beethoven symphony and something that speaks to the heart in such a way, and this is a product of just differential selection and for reproduction purposes. Human dignity, value, and purpose. Mm. And many people who are atheistic still want to treasure the idea of human dignity and value, but their whole worldview eliminates that idea that we are just the impersonal byproduct of a byproduct of an impersonal process. Human rights requires something bigger. Universal religious experience. What I try to tell, I appeal to their pride sometimes, their intellectual pride, and I will ask a person, have you at least, since Jesus has influenced history more than any other person when we consider the sum total, How many people have actually carefully read one of the Gospels instead of relying on second and third hand opinion? And I tell people, you owe it to yourself at least to make an informed, intellectually honest decision about whether you're going to accept or reject this one. Because to be indifferent or neutral about him is tantamount to rejecting him when he claims to have given his life for us. So at the end of the day, I say you owe it to yourself to at least read one of the Gospels, a primary historical document for yourself, and then make an informed decision as to whether you want to reject or accept him. But to be in the middle ground is not an option.
Ken, thank you. This has been an enlightening program. And listeners, you have a sense of not just how much Ken has to share, but how exciting it could be. If you do get a chance, get up to the Cove, September 20 to 22nd. The Cove, if you're from out of town, I'm in North Carolina here in the western side, and the Cove is up just outside Asheville. But you can Google the Cove, the Billy Graham Center, and find your way there on the Internet, and then hopefully find your way there in person. Ken, again, I want to thank you for this time and wish you every blessing as you continue to give the world a lot to think about, pointing them toward our great God and Creator.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed being with you.
This has been Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. And if you'd like to help support this ministry, or if you would like to know more about Beyond Words, visit us on our website at scriptureawakening.com.